Good morning. The Education and Employment Committee will now come to order. For the record, members, please remember to turn on your cell phone during roll call. Misty, please call the roll.
Chair Masullo?
Here.
Vice Chair Bell is excused. Committee Whip Hawkins?
Here.
Ranking Member Williams?
Here.
Representative Alvarez is excused. Representative Bankson?
Here.
Representative Basabi is excused. Representative Kennedy?
Here.
Representative Daniels? Representative Esposito?
Here.
Representative Fine?
Here.
Representative Franklin?
Present.
Representative Gonzalez Pittman?
Present.
Representative Coster is excused. Representative McLean?
Here.
Representative Mello?
Here.
Representative Trabulsi?
Here.
Representative Tuck?
Here.
Representative Valdez?
Present.
Representative Waldron?
Here.
Representative Woodson?
Here.
Thank you, Misty. Let the record show that a quorum is present. Members and guests, please remember to silence your communication devices. Members, I want to say that this morning, even though it seems a little early, we are honored today to have Dr. Nicholas Kaderas with us. He is a clinical psychologist and a well-known author, an internationally renowned speaker, and our country's foremost expert on mental health, addiction, as well as the impact of the digital age. He has authored several books, one which I highly recommend everyone, called Glow Kids, which is a seminal book on screen effects. He has a new book on digital madness, how social media is driving our mental health crisis. If you've not read these books, I recommend them to you highly. With that, I will turn our presentation over to Dr. Kaderas, and we will have time at the end of his presentation for questions. Welcome, Dr. Kaderas, to Florida, digitally.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here. Thank you for inviting me, and it's an honor to be in front of the esteemed committee. And yes, I'm up here in New York, and we're having a balmy 60 degrees with rain, so it's nice to be in Florida digitally or otherwise. I want to thank the committee for having me speak today about what I think is one of the most powerful and important topics of our time. And thank you. I want to thank this committee for taking bold initiative on being proactive on this issue, because I don't think we've seen enough proactive legislation to help protect our children, because at the end of the day, this is what this is about. I think it's important to understand that as a society, we've gone through a seismic shift over the last 10 to 15 years, how we function as a species. And it's important to realize quite how quickly it's all happened. We had the iPhone in 2007, the iPad in 2010. We've had Facebook in 2004, Instagram 2010, and TikTok in 2016. So that's been the blink of an evolutionary eye, but yet it feels like we've been swimming in digital culture for forever. I mean, those of us who are old enough to remember the before times can remember the different way that we interacted as human beings, the different way that we taught our children, the different ways that we experienced the world. What's interesting to note with our digital awakening or digital emergent is that it coincides with what we might call a mental health crisis, and this was predating COVID. So when you're looking at mental health metrics or psychiatric metrics over the last 10 to 15 years, we were increasingly escalating in, let me give you some examples. In 2019, before COVID, we had the highest rates of suicide. We had over 42,000 suicides in the country. We had over 70,000 drug overdoses. We had the highest rates of depression, the highest rates of anxiety, skyrocketing rates of ADHD. By every conceivable mental health metric, we were on fire as a society before COVID. And then COVID acted as kerosene to the fire with its quarantines and isolation and increased screen dependence. All the toxic dynamics that we now know are driving this mental health crisis were amplified during the screen dependence that emerged during COVID, including Zoom schooling. And we saw what that disaster looked like in terms of not only the mental health effects of our children and our students, but entire grade levels lost in their development. So this was all been happening in the last 10 to 15 years, people getting more unwell. And what was interesting is if you look at the psychiatric metrics, they get increasingly worse as people get increasingly younger. So if you look by cohort, if you go by generational cohort from baby boomer down to Gen X, down to millennial, down to Gen Z, interestingly enough, the younger, the more likely you are to have some kind of psychiatric disorder, the more likely you are to be unwell. There's now people are talking about there's a loneliness epidemic, and the younger the person, the more likely they are to feel lonely. In fact, one out of five millennials is claiming to have no friends. And this goes counter to the narrative that we were sold when social media first emerged onto the scene. We as a social species were going to now have this wonderful new elixir called social media, which was, you know, a social species, and social media should have been this ideal combination, chocolate and peanut butter, which it should have increased our wellness because social media was promising us connectivity and connection and social, cohesion. And what we've seen is just the opposite. The more plugged in the generation is or the cohort is, the more unwell they are. And now we have increasing research that helps us understand those dynamics. And it's really my job really here today to help this committee better understand what some of those relationships are like, why this is so, what is it about technology and screen immersion that's driving mental health. This committee is the education committee. And so there are two buckets three buckets actually that we have to look at. We have to look at screen impacts on mental health, so how they would be affecting students' mental well-being, screen impacts and cognition in terms of how they're affecting developmentally, everything from the ability to process information, retain information, and cognitive development. And the third bucket is pedagogical effects. Is screen time in schools pedagogically effective? Because there was a huge push, especially before COVID, to have entire classrooms be digitized, to have remote learning, to have, it was sold under the pretext of individualized learning, which would be better for the student. And we saw during COVID that screen-based or Zoom-based learning was a pedagogical disaster. So it's my hope that I can illuminate the committee a little bit with some of those dynamics so we could have a more, at least a better understanding of why screens in schools are not a very good thing for our students. And I say this not only as a researcher who's worked in this field for a while, and I've been a psychologist for over 20 years, and I've worked with over 2,000 young people, and I've seen the effects firsthand. I've seen the erosion of our young people's acuity, of their attention spans, of their interpersonal skills, of their increased mental health. I run treatment centers around the country, and you're seeing this malaise and skyrocketing unwellness amongst young people, an emptiness, a depression. And to a large part, if there's nothing that you get out of this conversation with me today, it's to understand that at the end of the day, digital media is essentially acts as a stimulant to young people who are not developmentally ready to handle what we call high octane or high impact stimulation. And there's been a lot of brain imaging research that has shown that this effect is very similar to cocaine on the brain. It impacts neurophysiologically the brain, and it makes people much more stimulation dependent, thus much more impulsive. It affects the parts of the brain, the prefrontal cortex, that are our executive functioning, that are our decision-making, that allow us to not be impulsive. We're priming an entire generation to be highly impulsive because of this digital immersion that we've all been swimming in. And it's important to note that big tech has now acknowledged the harms that are being caused. So I'm not alone in the choir now. We know through Frances Haugen, the Facebook whistleblower, with her Senate testimony, and with her 60 Minutes interview, that Instagram had internal research that showed 3 or 4 years ago now, they had their own research indicating that, especially for young adolescent females, being on Instagram was harmful. Increased suicidality by 12% in British girls, increased suicidality by 6% in American girls, an exacerbation of eating disorders by 17%. They know this, they knew this, they had internal emails saying, should we dampen the algorithms to make them less predatory and toxic? And the answer was no, because they understood well that even the harmful content led to higher engagement. And it was a perfect example of people over profits. And so social media, I've come to understand, has turned almost into a living organism that is baked. The algorithm is programmed just like a heat-seeking missile to seek psychological vulnerability. So social media targets, if the algorithm senses that a young person is struggling with body image, with identity, with whatever the issue may be, like a heat-seeking missile, it exploits that psychological vulnerability. It makes it worse, but that leads to engagement. And that's the point in time that we're at right now. We're having to defend children against the wealthiest corporations on the planet that are targeting them and their well-being and don't seem to care. But how did we get to this place? You know, what I'd like to get an understanding of, or at least share an understanding of, is how we got here, at least a little bit. It was interesting because way back in the before times of 1996, there was popular media, the cover of Newsweek, that said, can PCs make your kid a better student? And here you see a young girl with a Norman Rockwell-esque smile on, you know, this is a picture-perfect scene. She's got her laptop and she's smiling. And the promise here was that technology can be somehow good in our educational system. 16 years later, Newsweek ran a very different cover story called I Crazy, Panic, Depression, and internet connection. And here now we began to see the signs and the symptoms of what happens to our children when we're prematurely exposing them to technology. And that's a big part of the narrative. Age-appropriate technology is a big thing that I talk about a lot. No one is suggesting that we go Amish. No one is suggesting that we become Luddites. But what we're increasingly understanding is that children are developmentally fragile, and both neurologically and emotionally. And these devices are very powerful in the same way that an automobile is a powerful bit of technology. And so in the same way that we don't give the car keys to our seven-year-olds, we have been giving the car keys, metaphorical car keys, to technology to kids who are just too young to handle the information overload, the predatory addictive practices of some of the big tech conglomerates. And so we've seen what you see on your screen now, the zombie apocalypse, a teenage mental health crisis where young people are at most risk. Interestingly, what we're seeing is suicide rates going up in the time of the digital. The CDC had found that suicide rates for children from the ages of 10 to 14 had doubled from 2007 to 2014, the same time that social media began to surge. Suicide overtook motor vehicle accidents as a cause of death for that age group. And this last box is, I think, one of the most telling bits of research. The teens' use of electronics devices for at least 5 hours daily more than doubled. But the key part is that those teens who were on their devices for more than 5 hours a day were 70% more likely to have suicidal thoughts or actions than those who reported 1 hour of daily use. And that begs the question, what is it about being in front of a screen for several hours a day that's driving our young people to such a significant percentage, 70% increase in suicidality? Is it the content? Is it the device itself? Is it all of the above? And, well, we'll see a little bit more about what that is. This just came out this week. The CDC teen mental health report just came out a couple of days ago, and U.S. teen girls are experiencing increased sadness and violence. record levels of sadness, violence, and suicide risk. Nearly one in three, 30% of our teenage girls have seriously considered attempting suicide, up 60% over the last decade. And again, we have to ask ourselves, what's changed between now and over the last decade? And the common denominator is our tech love affair and the way that we, as the adults in the room who fell in love with our devices, admittedly, I think most of us were pretty smitten by how amazing our smartphones and our technology is, weren't quite fully aware, or let's call it underaware, about some of these impacts that it was having on our youngest and most vulnerable. So now we have an entire generation that's really screaming out for help. They're struggling and they're dying in record levels that we'd never seen before. Deaths of despair, suicide, overdose, chronic alcoholism, which are disproportionately affecting young people, have skyrocketed to over 200,000 deaths a year. So much so that for the first time, but this is before COVID in 2019, the average mortality rate for the average American started going down because so many young people were dying. The average age of death was now, for the first time in 100 years, for the first time since the influenza pandemic, since 1918, we started seeing our age of go down from 68, 69, 70, then down to 69 and 68 because of all of our young people dying. So before I mentioned that, we could begin to look at these tech impacts under three buckets. One bucket is mental health, one bucket is cognition, and the other bucket can be educational, pedagogical effects. So we have really robust research, just one particular study that I've pulled out that I think is one of the more telling, and this goes into the cognition bucket. This is a fairly recent 2019 JAMA, Journal of American Medical Association Pediatrics, looked at brain scans. This was a brain imaging study of 3 to 5 year olds and found that those who used screens more than the recommended hour a day without parental involvement had lower levels of brain development, neurophysiological brain development of their white matter. The white matter is also called the myelination or the myelin sheath of the brain, an area that's key for the development of language, literacy, and cognitive skills. This is the first study to document associations between higher screen use and lower measures of brain structure and skills in preschool age kids, said lead author Dr. John Hutton, a pediatrician and clinical researcher at Cincinnati Children's Hospital. This is important because the brain is developing the most rapidly in the first 5 years, Hutton said. That's when brains are very plastic and soaking up everything, learning these strong connections that last for life. So we're seeing that if we drop the tablet into the crib or at the earlier ages that we're exposing children to more and more screen time, the more developmental damage we're doing. And yet the Kool-Aid that many of us drank as parents or as educators was, we've got to keep up. Our children have to keep up in this digital age. And it's not enough that they get an iPad in ninth grade. It has to be fifth grade. And now it has to be first grade. And now it has to be preschool. And I joke around that, you know, we'll be looking at in utero screens one day soon, I think. So Johnny and Susie aren't somehow left behind. But in fact, what we're doing is we're not giving Johnny and Susie a leg up. We're actually stunting their development. And in fact, many neuroscientists have now using the D word, the dementia word, digital dementia, because we're beginning to see some of these neurological effects mirror what looks like dementia. Child psychologist Alina Telford, neuroscientists are predicting that current generations will present with a higher number of dementias, including early onset, and previous generations as a direct result of screen use. Screen time is a public health risk. Frighteningly, chronic sensory stimulation caused by screen use has been found to mirror similar presentations of adults who have early stage dementia, with people who are excessively using screens having difficulties in the area of concentration, orientation, memory, acquisition, and recall, as well as difficulties with self-care. Now, this doesn't sound like the ideal ingredient to be exposing our first graders or third graders or fifth graders to. We need to be cognizant of these impacts. This is not what television was. It's important to understand that those of us who are of a certain age, I think we made a critical mistake of conflating modern screen experiences with television. Most of us grew up on television, felt television was fairly innocuous, and didn't fully appreciate that the modern screen world, because of its immersive and interactive and ubiquitous nature, has a much more profound neurological and psychological impact on development. And we're just beginning to realize that a little bit late in the game, but we're beginning to realize the harms that are happening. In terms of clinical impacts, we can categorize those. And well, we know that habituation is now by design. Big Tech has admitted that they're hooking, you know, it's hook 'em young and hook 'em for life, using very sophisticated behavior modification techniques to, and I'll talk about the dopaminergic effect, how these platforms become habit forming. The more screen time you're on, the more aggressive the young person becomes. We have very, very robust research about increased depression and anxiety. We've seen increased self-harm, not just suicidality, but also cutting and other forms of self-harm, and an epidemic of ADHD, a generation of highly impulsive. ADHD rates have doubled in the last several years, and that's not because of higher diagnosis or higher sensitivity. That's because kids are more distractible because they become stimulation dependent. Kids raised on iPads at age 2 or 3 become stimulation dependent. So absent that stimulation, Johnny and Susie can't focus. The addictive piece relates to how dopamine arousing or dopaminergic these platforms can be. So I'm not going to belabor this point too much, but essentially screen experiences, as I mentioned earlier, are stimulants. They spike dopamine. We chase dopamine's feeling. Dopamine is the most critical neurotransmitter involved in any addictive process. And so anything that elevates dopamine significantly has the potential for addiction. And what we've seen in a 1998 study by Dr. Cope, who looked at certain experiences and substances that raise dopamine, for example, food raises dopamine 50%, sex raises dopamine 100%, cocaine 350%. What they found in 1998 was that video games were as dopaminergic as sex. There were 100% dopamine spiking. And even more problematic, because digital experiences, without being crude at this time of the morning, can last much longer than the sexual experience. I've had gamers in my treatment programs or other types of screen addicts who have been in front of their screen literally for days without sleep. I've had gamers who, 16, 17-year-old gamers who wear adult diapers because they won't go to the bathroom while they're gaming. In fact, if you Google World of Warcraft and adult diapers, you'll see entire chat rooms devoted to which are the best adult diapers for teenagers to wear so they don't ever have to leave their screen. And if that's not addiction, then by any other name. There's been robust research about the ADHD effect. Dr. Christakis, who's the editor of the journal, American Journal of Pediatrics, he's done a lot of this research. He did it early research on television effects on ADHD, then with immersive tablets. Essentially, TV, the critical developmental stages for ADHD are ages 2 to 6. And they found that a kid who watches an hour of television between ages of 2 and 6 for every hour of TV viewing, that a 10% higher rate of ADHD. They did that same research with immersive and interactive tablets in 2015 was that later study. And they found that that effect was greatly exacerbated. So the more immersive and stimulating the screen experience is, the higher propensity towards ADHD disorders down the road. There's been very robust research for decades out of Iowa State that looks at the effect of violent media and aggression and violence. And this was really seminal research done by Dr. Craig Anderson and his team, as I said, for over 30 years. And the one most important study, there was an exhaustive meta study that looked at 130 research studies, 130,000 participants. And they published those results in the APA Journal of Psychological Bulletin in 2010. And they concluded that violent media are not just a correlation, but a causal risk factor for increased aggressive thoughts and behavior. Now, that aggressive behavior could look like more fights in school, hitting your brother or sister, or more violent types of behavior beyond that. Social media, as I mentioned earlier, is the big lie. It's the promise of social connection, and in fact, it's been the big disconnect. And it's been the main driver of the depression and self-harming machine that's happening now with young people, when the primary reason why young females on something like Instagram are hurting themselves is something called the comparison effect. And in fact, there have been about three or four studies that looked at Facebook depression. And one study showed that the more Facebook friends we have, the more likely we are to be depressed. And the reason is because we have more people to compare ourselves to. So if I'm having a not so great day and I have 500 Facebook friends, and let's face it, what do we post on social media but our most idealized, externalized self? And in today's influencer culture, let's face it, now you have our young people comparing themselves to curated, artificial influencers who, the Kylie Jenners of the world, who only amplify a young person's feeling of low self-worth, I'm not good enough. And so we have all the issues of photoshopping. You know, it's the curation of how we, a person sees themselves. And so not only are now people hurting themselves because they don't think that they measure up, but we also have the proliferation of things like cyberbullying, where, you know, once upon a time, 30 or 40 years ago, when we all went through the rite of passage of high school and there was bullying, now it's gone viral. And so we've seen just in the last week, we've had a couple of very high profile suicides where young teenage girls who had been bullied or attacked, and the videos have gone viral, have wound up killing themselves. We also have for the first time the phenomenon of pediatric suicide. When I was doing my training almost 30 years ago, pediatric suicide, meaning suicide between the ages of 5 and 10, was not a thing. There was not even a statistic for it. Now there are children between the ages of 5 and 10 who are killing themselves. And I think everybody on this committee who cares about kids, I'm a father of teen boys, we have to ask ourselves, what's happening in the world and the lived reality of young people that a 6 or 7 or 8 year old not only understands what suicide is, but is so driven by his or her life to the point of ending their life in an age where children should still be playing with blocks outdoors with other friends. And now we're having this pediatric suicide epidemic as well. According to the World Health Organization now, depression is second only to heart disease as the leading cause of disability. We are getting increasingly depressed, not only nationally, but globally. Depression is now a global epidemic, and it is again correlating with our ever-increasing dependence and reliance on technology. When you think about two main dynamics that are involved when we're all tech connected, we're more sedentary and we tend to be isolated and alone in front of a screen. And as a psychologist, what we prescribe when somebody has mild to moderate depression, the two non-pharmacological interventions we always prescribe is exercise and social connection. So think about that: physical movement, exercise, and social connection. But what technology does is it makes one sedentary and it makes a person disconnected from meaningful social interactions with the illusion of counterfeit connection through these digital friendships or followers. So we're also seeing spread via social media platforms from TikTok on down. There's a really fascinating phenomenon that's proliferating right now where it's called digital social contagion. Some of you may have read about this. It's got a lot of press. It was in Rolling Stone magazine, and a lot of pediatricians were commenting on it. But in the last couple of years, we saw a couple of thousand adolescent girls who were manifesting Tourette's disorder, or this, they were showing signs of Tourette's disorder. And when their pediatricians looked at their whole profile, they discovered that they were following three prominent TikTok Tourette's influencers, three women who were getting billions of views on TikTok. because of their over-the-top performative Tourette's disorder, and all of a sudden now the teenage girls that were following these Tourette's influencers started mimicking in true social contagion, monkey see, monkey do fashion. Whether it was conscious or unconscious, they started mimicking their Tourette's disorder. Now we've seen that also with this dissociative identity disorder, which we used to call multiple personality disorder. We've seen that with borderline personality disorder. We're seeing whole subcultures devoted to chat rooms and Reddits and entire communities forming that amplify and, in fact, not only normalize, but make aspirational certain psychiatric wellness. Because let's face it, what's popular on social media? Not the thoughtful discourse, but performative, highly reactive. The things that push our lizard brain or activate our lizard brain is what creates engagement. So the most performative and over-the-top influencers, whether it's Kylie Jenner or somebody with multiple personality disorder, right now there are influencers on social media that are called systems. These are the multiple personality folks who claim to have over 100 identities, the whole LGBTQI spectrum of identities. And I've looked at them and it's nonsense. They don't generally have dissociative disorder. I've worked with dissociative disorder. These are performances that are being done, but they're having an impact on people who are now lost and vulnerable and maybe have no core sense of identity, who are now latching on to identity through these subgroups. From an educational standpoint, I wrote a Time magazine article back in the before times, or at least before COVID, about screens in the classroom. And you could see in the title, it was Screens in Schools Are a $60 Billion Hoax. Time magazine reprinted that in their special education edition this last year. And we really looked at, we know that screens can have this mental health negative impact, but is it even worth the spend, the effort pedagogically? Are there better outcomes with technology in classrooms or what have you? And so we have a couple of seasoned teachers, Joe Clement and Matt Miles, wrote a really insightful book called Screen School a couple of years ago. And they talked about a dynamic called the Googlefication of the classroom, where students were using Google or depending on search engines so much that can work for the earlier grades as a way to look something up. But as they got older, the observations amongst many, many teachers and educators were that the Googlefication of the classroom robbed students of critical thinking, inference, and the ability to weave facts into a cohesive tapestry. In other words, I could look up the War of 1812, but I didn't understand the context of the War of 1812 unless I had a deeper Socratic circle, question and answer interaction with a educated teacher, that just looking stuff up wasn't the best way to educate people. This slide, I just want to point out, because as I'm being mindful of our time, looks at the two things here that I want to point out without getting too specific with it. We found that screen time does one very significant thing to students. It's a nuclear bomb on their love of reading. Kids who are prone to screen time are bored reading. I think we just have to think about that for a minute. Though any of us who have watched any action movie, Liam Neeson, Taken, or anything that's sort of high octane or adrenaline surging, now imagine you have to go read War and Peace after you've had your adrenaline surged. You can't do it. It makes every other experience boring. And so we found that, according to research, kids who read on screens are 3 times less likely to say that they enjoy reading. Why that's really significant for the future of our students is the top two studies in this slide. A 2013 study in Psychological Science that followed 17,000 people from birth to age 50 found that reading level at age 7 was the most important indicator of future socioeconomic status. And another study that year from the Organization for Economic Cooperation found that reading for pleasure at age 15 was the most important indicator for future success. So reading proficiency at age 7 and love of reading at age 15 were critical ingredients to our young people's development and growth. Reading is an important process that happens where students have to use their active imagination. They have to visualize the words, have to be translated into imagery in their minds. That's a process that's important. And all you need to know is that the most powerful minds in technology, Sergey Brin, Larry Page, the Google boys, they were Montessori students. Jeff Bezos was a Montessori student. So the most powerful minds in technology, and of course, I'm sure you've all heard that Steve Jobs didn't allow his own children to have iPads. They understood that these devices are dampening of natural brain development and social development. They don't allow their kids, they themselves didn't have technology as they were growing up. Their brains were allowed to fully develop. And yet they feel that it's okay for our kids to have their devices and to monetize and exploit our children. When you read something on paper versus a radiant screen, the retention rate is 20% less. This was research that was done by Ann Magan, a reading researcher. And that's because there's a physicality to the page. So when you read something on paper, there's a north, east, south, and west, and it gives you a mnemonic point of reference when you try to recall material. And, you know, we have a couple of insights that I'll just quickly go over. Again, the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, they had a report that heavy users of computers in the classroom do, quote, a lot worse than most learning outcomes, and that in the end, technology can amplify great teaching, but great technology cannot replace poor teaching. And then an exhaustive meta-study by Durham University that looked at 48 studies examining technologies and their impact on learning found that, quote, technology-based interventions tend to produce just slightly lower levels of improvement when compared with other research interventions and approaches, things like smaller classroom settings and other types of supports. Patricia Greenfield, distinguished professor of psychology at UCLA, analyzed more than 50 studies on learning and points out that reading for pleasure among young people has decreased, as I pointed out before, which is problematic because, quote, studies show that reading develops imagination, induction, reflection, and critical thinking, as well as vocabulary in a way that visual media such as video games and television do not. I want to jump to my last slide here because these are just more supportive quotes. Well, the one that is interesting here is Finland, who is always at the top of the world rankings of the best educational systems. They've rejected technology in the classroom. They do have smart boards, but they've rejected individual phones or any kind of other portable devices to be used in education. Their minister of education felt that there would be distractions, and they are given much more outdoor free playtime than our kids are here in the United States. And finally, I want to conclude with phones in the classroom. This was a specific study that specifically looked at that point. This was done at the London School of Economics, and they looked at, and the name of the study was Ill Communication, the Impact of Mobile Phones on Student Performance. When, and this was a large study with over 40,000 students, when phones were removed from the classroom, standardized test scores went up by 6.4%. And indeed, the standardized test scores of lower socioeconomic and special needs students went up 14% just by removing the phones. The researchers concluded in their conclusion that the best way to reduce the achievement gap is to remove the phones from the classroom. It's a low-cost way for schools to increase their educational testing. So that concludes my actual PowerPoint presentation.
Dr. Kaderis, that was excellent and extremely enlightening. Members, any questions? Rep. Valdez, you're recognized.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. And wow, what an intriguing and informative presentation. Thank you so much. My question is, we currently require computer-based progress monitoring tests as early as 4 and 5 years old. Is this potentially harmful in contributing to the screen time versus the social media type of screen time that you described?
Yeah, so if we look at screen experiences on a continuum, you know, sometimes we'll analogize it to like substance use on the continuum. THC may not be as problematic as crystal meth. So in the screen continuum, some standardized testing isn't as problematic, or, you know, the high octane, the more problematic screen experiences are, well, things like gaming and social media, but also too much screen content presented, too much educational content presented via screens. So standardized testing as a one-off or a random event isn't the worst thing in the world, although it may not be ideal, but it's not as harmful as 6 hours a day of Zoom schooling and or social media drowning and gaming. You know, it tends to be a gender divide, by the way. Young adolescent boys tend to gravitate towards gaming and have gaming problems, and younger females tend to gravitate towards social media, and those tend to be their digital problems more so.
Yeah, you're recognized for follow-up.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Considering that response, sometimes, well, a lot of times, schools and classrooms use programs like iReady, which is they're individualized for that student's achievement, and it grades them from where they are and gives them that support that they need. So what I'm hearing is that even that might not be a good way to educate the children as well, because they're going to have more screen time. Would that be a correct assumption?
Correct. And I'm the husband of a elementary school teacher of 25 years. And
thank you for her.
She would share that sentiment as well.
Thank you very much.
There's no substitute for the Socratic interaction, the question and answering of a teacher with a student. These learn at your own pace, individualized programs. That's how they're sugarcoating their product. It's that it's individualized learning, but it's not in the ideal format that students learn the best in.
Rep. Trubolsky, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Doctor, thank you for being with us today. I have read the book Glow Kids and also listened to the podcast Read White and Blue when you made a guest appearance there. My question to you is, when we make a decision to pull back on screen time with our children, can you please speak to the withdrawal effects and how we cope with that?
Well, so I run treatment programs where I've seen some pretty extreme cases of withdrawal. You know, there are some young people who, again, it's like a stimulant drug. And so there is increased aggression, irritability. Picture, you know, those of you who may be coffee drinkers, if you don't have coffee for a couple of days, what's your mood like? How do you tend to react? So we see extreme dysregulation, increased aggression in the extreme cases. In other cases, it's more moderated, but sometimes what's recommended is to titrate their screen usage down gradually. So you're not just unplugging somebody who's been on screens for eight or 10 hours a day to go cold turkey will lead to more of the problematic withdrawal that you're talking about. If you do it gradually, if you have them, if you replace the activity with a more natural activity like a recreation, a team, a sport, a musical instrument, you're almost then replacing, I call it dopamine replacement therapy, right? If we can replace the screen experience with something more real, then they don't notice it as much. If you just have somebody sitting in the room alone without a device, they're going to get angry.
May I have a follow-up, Mr. Chair?
You're recognized for follow-up.
Thank you. If we limited that screen time in school, if we made the decision to do that, would you expect the same type of withdrawal in school? And would you suggest completely eliminating it, do that tighter down that you spoke about? And then how are teachers in school settings that you've worked in, how have they managed that transition?
Yeah, what tends to not work is having out-of-sight policies where kids are allowed to have their phones as long as they don't take them out, because then the teacher spends literally half the period telling the three or four of the five kids, put your phone away, put your phone away, and it really takes away from instructional time. So what we've seen work the best is school-wide policies where we say, and by the way, New York City, where I'm from, New York, for many years under Mayor Bloomberg had a no-phone policy that was reversed under Mayor de Blasio, but the largest school system in the country had a no-phone policy. And worked pretty effectively because it was school-wide, city-wide, and that was the expectation. So there's less pushback and dysregulation when it's executed consistently and decisively. Like, this is going to be the new rule. There are going to be no phones in school, and it's going to be no social media in school. It's going to be just for educational. Now, whether you decide to have the kids check in their phones at a central office when they first come in, or some classes would have little pouches, that's the best way to do it.
Rep. Walton, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question is maybe more from a parental perspective, but if you acknowledge that, you know, this the phones, iPads, social media is somewhat of a necessary evil at this point, what's your advice to parents, how to monitor, how to regulate it, when they should introduce it to their child, and how to introduce it? I guess it's kind of a large question, but thanks.
Yeah, people oftentimes ask what's the right age of a child, a smartphone, or what I can say. I mean, I'm the parent of teenage boys, as I mentioned. I have twins who are 15. The best advice that I've heard and that I give is delay, delay, delay. The older your child is, you know, let's face it, our kids are going to get devices. The question is, the older that they are, the more neurologically equipped they are to handle it, and the more socially equipped they are to handle it. So a four-year-old is going to have a much more difficult time than a 14-year-old. There's a national movement called wait until eighth grade to give your child a device. There's the Gab phone. The Gab phone looks like a smartphone, but it's not Wi-Fi compatible. So you can text your kids and they could listen to music on it, and it looks like a smartphone, so they don't get stigmatized as like they have a dumb phone or flip phone. So there are other products out there that allow parents to communicate with their kids and are good stopgaps right now. But the advice to parents is, as much as you can, delay the
Thank you.
Rep. Woodson, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Dr. Cardaris, for this enlightening presentation. My question to you, I have two questions, actually, Mr. Chair, if I may.
You're recognized for both. Go ahead.
The first one is, we know we have a major issue. And based on research, on your presentation as well, we're seeing how this is really affecting our kids. And we have some parents who try to monitor the kids. However, we have some other parents who don't see the importance of monitoring those kids. And some of them do not have the time because they work in two or three jobs. How do you think we can approach this issue in order to help those kids whose parents cannot monitor the issue of spending too much time on the screen?
I think it's creating a culture, a collaborative community and parent. All the stakeholders in this are the educators, the parents, the students, and creating a culture where everyone supports one another in this new initiative of understanding how toxic this is. When I treat young people, no young person likes to be told what to do. I don't think any of us, when we were 15 or 16, wanted to be told what to do. So what I find an effective intervention in helping reduce the usage of a young person's screen time or entirely getting off social media, I'll show them the documentary, The Social Dilemma. The Social Dilemma pulls back the curtains for those of you that have not seen it, and are the most powerful people in tech explaining how they're manipulating their users. And they use the word users, interestingly, which is similar to drug addicts, they're users. And when I show that to teenagers and I say, you see what's happening here? You're being played. You're being manipulated. You're being monetized. You want to be played by someone? So I'll provoke that response that most teenagers have of not wanting to be manipulated. And so when they understand that when they're on social media, algorithms are targeting them, big tech oligarchs are really using them as just monetization entities, I've got many young people who've gotten angry, who have unplugged, who have been much more moderated in their usage. And it's easier to do that than to just try to restrict their usage. Explain to them why they should be creating their own sense of core identity rather than letting letting social media dictate their identities and their usage and all these other things.
You're recognized for your second.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My second question to you, Dr. Kadaris, has to do with the Finland model that is working. We know it's working. It's proven that it's a method that can be replicated. Would you recommend that our U.S. education system look at the Finland model and try to make some changes in the United States? Most likely I'm concerned about Florida because we live in Florida. But is that something that you recommend, that we look at the model in order to ensure that our children are really learning as they should and try to avoid some of those later effects that it might have on the mental or on the psyche?
100%. In the same way that Finland is a role model for the whole world, Florida can become a role model for the country. And, you know, I give so much credit to Florida and factors, but I agree with that statement 100% that if it is done and be a role model for the rest of the country, it would be phenomenal and life-saving, quite honestly, life-saving.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You're welcome. Ranking Member Williams, you're recognized.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As you spoke about the suicide rate increasing 1 in 3, you mentioned that females is impacted more than males. Can you explain to us why is that in the age group that we're speaking of?
Yeah, you know, those of us of a certain age remember way back in the 80s or 90s, they used to talk about the fashion industry was driving eating disorders and anorexia. So like Vogue magazine was to blame for or contributing to a young vulnerable girl's body image or sense of idealized body shape. Now think about Vogue magazine was a static magazine that lived on an end table. Now we have our young females that are living in 24/7 imagery of idealized, photoshopped, curated influencer world. It's Vogue magazine times a million on steroids. And so the shaping influences of a much more constant. You can't escape it. You can't be a 16, 17-year-old and not be exposed to so much of this. Young boys tend to, while they may be on social media, they're leaning towards gaming a little bit more, which has its own issues. But it's the young girls who are beginning to hate themselves and create this sort of suicide profile.
Ranking Member Williams, are you okay?
I'm fine.
All right. Rep Hopkins, you're recognized for question.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just want to take advantage of the time having you here to tell you something that me and some other parents observed, and you can tell me if any of your colleagues or you have looked at this. It's when it comes to those age where, you know, life happens. I know pretty much everybody in this room, probably at 15, couldn't wait to get their learner's permit to drive. My daughter and her group of friends, both male and female, all waited till pretty much 18 or older before they even got the permit. So when we were together as parents, I said, you know, let's ask them why. Well, one, they had spent so much time on a screen, they didn't even realize how to operate a car. Some others talked about not knowing the rules of the road because they're not watching how their parents drive and what they could do. But the most profound one was, I wouldn't even know how to get where I'm going because I've never watched you take that route. Are you seeing this play into other aspects other than driver's license and things like that being delayed?
Yeah, traditional rites of adolescence, rites of passages, like getting a driver's license. I was just on the Dr. Phil show a couple of weeks ago, and I was also on this podcast, and he brought up exactly what you just mentioned about how he couldn't. Well, he was like a bat out of hell trying to get his permit when he was 15, and now his grandkids could care less, exactly what you're saying. And that's been written about quite a bit. So rites of passage like getting a driver's license, your first sexual experience, not to be crude. So dating, you know, normalized dating, courtship patterns. Kids are not playing varsity sports, by the way, is another one. in my community here in Southampton, New York, for the first time in 45 years, they couldn't field a varsity football team because the kids just weren't interested. It took too much effort to go out and to, it's much easier to be an e-athlete and to be playing, you know, League of Legends at home. So we're seeing kids kind of stunting themselves developmentally. They don't know how to socially interact in terms of romantic relationships. They don't want to get their driver's license, exactly for what you just said. It's, they're comfortable at home in front of the screen. Who needs to drive anywhere? So these are all subtle and not so subtle effects that are affecting our young people, and it's not going to serve them well. The other thing that we overlook a lot is it doesn't instill or nurture resilience. Being in an instant gratification screen world for young people, let's face it, we all became the adults that we were because we had a bump. We had to get a few bruises along the way. We had to experience life on life's terms, and there's some growth. You know, that scar tissue leads to growth and new skin. A lot of our young people, whether it's via helicopter parenting or just living in the screen world, don't get those life's bumps and bruises that can lead to resilience and grit. Grit is a very important psychological term that's being thrown around a lot lately. And our screen kids ain't got it. They're not gritty and they're not resilient. And we see that time and time again.
Members, we have time for just two more questions. Rep. Waldron, you're recognized for a follow-up, and then Rep. Trubolsky.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My question goes to corporate responsibility, because you talked a little bit about, you know, knowing, you know, the algorithms that are being used and things like that. I mean, so maybe it's a stretch, but it sort of harkens back to how, you know, the tobacco industry issue, right, and how they targeted children, young adults, to get them hooked. Do you feel that there's some similarity here and that the corporations should maybe
Absolutely. There's several class action suits right now that are mimicking both Big Tobacco and Big Pharma playbook, both with OxyContin and Purdue Pharmaceuticals and Big Tobacco, where there was internal knowledge that tobacco was a carcinogen. They hid that, and they sold Joe Camel to kids anyway. And so I think the sword that can be most effectively used are class action suits, because that hurts them where it hurts them most in their bottom line, but also legislation. You know, they right now, big tech enjoys Section 230 protection, so they can't be sued because they're ostensibly not publishers, but meanwhile they are acting as publishers. So there are legislative initiatives on the federal level, like a repeal of Section 230. There's antitrust legislation because they're certainly operating as monopolies. And Lena Khan, the chairman of the FTC, has wrote a seminal paper about the shifting role of antitrust laws and how it's gone from protecting an industry, you know, when we broke up Ma Belt to Baby Bells, and because they were a monopoly. Well, now we have big tech monopolies, but we're not breaking them up because now antitrust laws have moved towards being consumer favoring. So Amazon may be a monopoly, but if you can get a better price on that, you know, pillow that you're ordering, there it's being looked at the other way. So we definitely have to look at some legal approaches. I know in the Senate they have the online Senator Blumenthal and Blackburn had proposed the Online Safety Act, which would allow people to opt out of algorithms, but that has not been voted on. It's been proposed as of last February, and it's sort of stalled in the Senate. So there are legislative tools that can be used to defang, I think, some of these harms.
Rep. Trubolsky,
thank you very much.
Last question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Going back to limiting screen time in a school setting, in New York, when they imposed the no screen time, did you notice or was there any type of study done that showed that there was an increase in performance and decrease in possible bullying and suicide? Or if there wasn't a study there, is there a study done that shows since they reverted that there has been a decrease in performance, an increase in suicide and bullying?
Well, the one phone study that I cited at the end showed that there was an increase in standardized test scores. So there was an increase in academic performance. I don't have a study that looked at what happened with bullying when phones were removed from the classroom. I would have to speculate. You know, just anecdotally, when we're seeing so many of these conflicts and fights and bullying are so phone and social media related, that if you eliminated that as the as the conduit that you would have to see a lessening of that. I think it needs to happen. It's inevitable because right now, whenever a student sits in a classroom and they have a phone in their pocket, they have a highly habit-forming, arousing device that's calling their name. And they've even found that if you're sitting next to a student who has their phone out, you're more distracted than the kid who has the phone because now you're trying to look at their phone and you're not focusing on the teacher or what's being taught. You're not focusing on that dopamine pump that's sitting on that desk or in that kid's back pocket. So we remove the temptation. And so now you can focus on what needs to be focused on. But as long as the temptation is proximate or in their pockets or on that desk, it's a losing battle. You can't tell somebody, the heroin addict, ignore the bag of heroin in front of you and focus on A, B, or C. It's just not going to happen.
Dr. Kaderis, we really appreciate your time. It seems like our young people are going to have to walk through a minefield facing all these various dangers that our society, culture, and technology has put upon them. As we as a legislature try to deconstruct the various parts, how would you recommend we prioritize our process as far as what features we should look at in a free society to try to improve the situation?
Yeah, so the recommendations that I think work most effectively are preserve K through 8. K through 8 should be, especially well, K through 6 should be technology-free zones. K through 6 is the most critical developmental period of a child's development. So there should be no Kool-Aid drank that somehow Johnny or Susie in second grade needs any kind of a device. So K through 6 should be technology-free zones. Desktop computers in computer labs in 7th and 8th grade are the better gateway into technology usage, not allowing K through 8 any portable devices, phones or iPads or otherwise. And then waiting until high school to really then say, okay, now at this stage at age 13 and 14, you're developmentally more capable of driving the digital car. So now we're going to, you know, whether it's an iPad or a Chromebook, have it potentially be part of an integrated lesson world. But preserving K through 8 to be as, in the same way that Sergio Brin and Larry Page became these brilliant technical wizards at Stanford University because they had a Montessori K through 8 experience. I'm not saying that every public school should go Montessori, but the one ingredient in Montessori was no tech till 8th grade. I would think that that would be the gold standard moving forward. And then, of course, having social media, of course, not be in the classrooms. But if the phones are in the classroom, then social media is going to be in the classroom.
Dr. Kaderis, we really thank you for your time today. My hope is everyone in the state watch this presentation on the Florida Channel, that it is recorded. And we want to thank you again and wish you the best in your balmy New York weather.
Thank you, and best of luck with your initiatives as well. Thank you for having me here, and get Godspeed, and God bless you all. Thank you.
Very good. Members, this ends our business for today. And without objection, Rep. Woodson, move we rise. We are adjourned.